Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs and I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers, leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Monday, the 12th of August. Coming up on the program, the case against Ace Magashule seemingly getting stronger. Is South Africa's food security under increasing pressure? I'll tell you about the real value of an Olympic gold medal and one of the country's leading real estate agents on seasonal home buying and if it's the right time to enter the market pre-summer. The legal team representing the ex-personal assistant of former Free State Premier Ace Magashule say they're confident that she will be released on bail when she appears in court. Morwadi Tsholota landed at OR Tambo late last week, after she was extradited from the United States of America. I want to try and make some sense of all of this and why it is important. News 24 legal writer and author Karen Morn is with me on the importance of this case and, as I say, the legal complexities. Karen, why is this case considered significant then within the broader context of this investigation into asbestos tender corruption?
Well, essentially, Morwadi Tsholota is the state's link between certain of the transactions that they say constituted the corrupt benefits to Ace Magashule, that essentially she solicited what they claim were corrupt benefits from key business people, notably the murdered businessman Igor Mpambeni, in order to secure the asbestos tender, that as soon as payments were made for that contract, which the state said was corrupt, was essentially a rent-seeking exercise, she would then get these various monies for various projects or people that Ace Magashule wanted payments for. And so she was originally supposed to be a state witness because the state obviously realized that she had this linchpin quality to her. But when she became uncooperative, refused to give a statement or answer the police's questions in September 2021, the state then realized that they would have to charge her and that extradition process obviously concluded successfully.
How much money is involved here, Karen?
255,000 rand and 27,000 rand, 20 million rand, and 27 million of that was allegedly used to pay off various government officials.
There are reports that she was coerced into coming back to South Africa. How do you interpret that?
Well, she made that plea to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and it didn't fly. It didn't fly with the Constitutional Court in South Africa, who also rejected the same application where she made those allegations. It seemed from what the state said that she had responded badly to the process of transitioning from being a potential state witness to then being warned, as the law requires the state to do, that she was now a suspect. And she said it was because she didn't want to give the state the information that she's trying to suggest it was trying to coerce from her to falsely implicate Magashule. The state and the American authorities made it clear in that extradition case that, amongst other things, there was strong evidence of her direct involvement in the scheme, not least of all being a second bank account in which it says she received a number of payments from quote unquote service providers, people linked to service providers, ANCs, ANC members, individuals with a close relationship with Magashule. So certainly there are a lot of questions that are going to come out in this case.
On the broader canvas of state capture, how important is this?
It's very important because obviously the NPA has suffered a number of quite embarrassing defeats, not least of all was the New Lane case, which was the first state capture trial linked to the Estina Dairy Project case, where that matter ended in a 174 discharge application. In other words, the judge in that matter said the state hadn't even presented enough evidence to justify a response from the defense, and that is massively humiliating. We recently saw, in somewhat different circumstances, the Estina case being struck from the roll, Marcello Coco's matter being struck from the roll in circumstances where the state is now making certain averments about the magistrate. But the fact of the matter is, all these years later, we have yet to see a state capture conviction. The public is hungry for it. The public wants to see this kind of consequence accountability. And in this matter, having read the papers, having seen the level of evidence that convinced American authorities to extradite Charlotta, I think that there is a very good chance that they will succeed here.
Potentially, where does this leave the former premier of the Free State?
Well, I mean, if he faces a corruption conviction, it's you know, 15 years potentially behind bars. His political prospects seem to be nowhere near what they were when he was pronouncing that, you know, this was all a conspiracy, very much utilizing the language of the former president. But I think if I were his lawyers, I would be worried. They, of course, are going to argue that he didn't receive direct benefits, that there were no evidence of any payments made directly to them. But the state is saying that this is a sophisticated mechanism of benefits. And certainly those question marks over those payments into Charlotta's second bank account are going to come up very much in this case.
In terms of bail, how do you think this is going to go, and how strong a case is there going to be to resist it?
Well, we saw that Advocate Deneysen, Johan Deneysen, in court today saying that, you know, the state simply doesn't trust Moradi Charlotta. She started out as a state witness. She has done everything in her power to resist coming to court after initially saying that she would hand herself over voluntarily. They are going to put up major resistance, but I would be quite surprised, Jeremy, given that all the other accused in this case have been granted bail, that she isn't, but I think that the state will push very hard for quite stringent conditions.
What do we know about her, Karen, and how influential she was?
She is, she's 37 years old. There were big question marks, for instance, over the mechanisms by which she came to go and study in Washington, which was, of course, where she was when she was extradited. That, you know, the American authorities in that extradition application saying that there was strong evidence that she didn't, she didn't comply with the conditions that were granted for that particular scholarship program. And certainly the evidence that the state presented very much shifted the dynamic from her being, you know, an innocent participant who had simply sent emails potentially at the behest of Magashule to someone who was a knowing and active participant in this allegedly corrupt scheme. Of course, I think she is going to persist with this allegation that she has been coerced, that she is an unfortunate victim, that in fact she is, you know, didn't want to implicate her former boss in something that he did not do. But certainly the forensic paper trail that the state has managed to produce, and which convinced the American state, the U.S. attorney, their equivalent of the NPA, to endorse this extradition application, I think is going to require some quite detailed responses from her.
And just quickly, inevitably, this particular case could have some influence, I imagine, on any future extradition proceedings involving high-profile figures.
Well, you know, I think that in the New Lane and the Estina cases, unfortunately, both of those, which were the ones that were going to be linked to bringing the Guptas back, both of those at this point are legally dead in the water. But I think that if you look at the level of effort that was done in this case by the Free State NPA office, which were not part of the investigating directorate, I think it really is a lesson to the NPA about how to get an extradition done. And of course, the Americans were extremely cooperative. There was clear political will from them to assist us. And I think that cannot be taken away from this matter, given that the state has expressed reservations about the way in which, for instance, the UAE responded to its extradition request for the Guptas.
One of the country's top legal writers, News 24, Karen Morn. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you that food insecurity is a feature of life for many South Africans. It refers to a lack of regular access to enough safe and nutritious food for average growth and development and an active and healthy life. My next guest, Professor Adrino Mazenda from the School of Public Management and Administration at the University of Pretoria, says in many respects this is due to unavailability of food, or perhaps more tellingly, a lack of resources to buy it. So, Professor, welcome to you. How bad then is the problem? And I'm wondering if it's increasing.
Based on the recent surveys that are coming, you can see that this problem, I think, is worsening. Based on the issues like, for example, issues of unemployment, it's going on and on. Energy prices, though right now we talk about load shedding has eased, and you know a lot of people maybe have decided to add alternative energies. But and also you've been looking at how companies have been closing, right? A lot of companies have been leaving the country, right? Because of a lot of other issues to do with the political, socio-economic environment. So you can see these are the challenges that are affecting people, especially the issues of unemployment. And then you can see also worsening the case is, at one time I was talking about where Parliamentary Monitoring Group, they reported about the issue of, but imagine how important the EPWP is, Expanded Public Works Program. Suddenly they were saying they are going to not disperse any amounts of money in 2024-25. Why? Because there have been the issues of reporting and budgets which are aligning from different municipalities. So these are initiatives which are supposed to help the poor and the communities. So based on these aspects, you can see now it worsens. And also based also these issues, at one time people are talking about the agrarian issues, land reform and other aspects. There are many issues which are a lot of silos. And also so there is need for about stakeholders to come through. So if you look also in the statistics from HSRC recent survey, you know, over about more than about 20-30% of people are in severe food operating. They've got severe food insecurity. If you want to translate that as into poverty, you know, poverty has got the 10 dimensions with housing, etc., wash, water, sanitation, health, etc. You could see that about 50% of South Africans, 55% are regarded as poor. So you can see that worsening to the socioeconomic environment, it becomes worse. So I don't know now, at least maybe it becomes optimistic, the GNU and maybe a lot of other changes which can be done in the municipalities.
Well, let's talk about how the GNU needs to reprioritize this issue. But let me suggest to you as well, Professor, that the tragedy of this is it is a societal problem that seems to creep up. It's almost the hidden hand, and all of a sudden we are confronted with the reality. And maybe it's something that we don't get in front of quick enough.
Yes, that's very true. These are the societal issues. And also remember, from the society issues, because we're talking about many studies have been done on food security, how can we improve nutrition and the like. So also people in the societies need to come on board. Let's take, for example, from the studies that we did, you could hardly see that any of these even poor households, even in the locations, like we did a study in Swane 7 regions, where we're targeting some poor households based on the community life survey, which was done in 2016 for a stratified random sampling proportional to size. You could see that most of these households, they don't even have a backyard garden at the back, not even rearing livestock. And you can see the communities, there's not much being done. So I think to counter those aspects, the society first, there should be issues whereby people are able to grow, to have some projects that they do in the local communities where people can buy there. Because now what happens is the issues of poverty, which worsens a lot of issues, comes through food, you know, food prices and all these aspects. So if you do that, I think that can be better. And also, whilst we do this government support that can be done by municipalities, we talk about this skilling and the like. So I think those aspects also should come hand in hand, especially there is more like employment in the agriculture sector. It can be. So that is an area which needs to be explored by the government and all stakeholders. Then they see how can they benefit the people. Exactly. Yeah, I think that could also work.
Professor, how do you think better coordination then among government agencies can help improve the implementation of the policies that you're talking about?
Right. I think if you look into that, let's look from a policy perspective first. So we could see that there are many policies that have been done by municipalities trying to do these issues of food security. We're talking about food banks, food gardens, and a lot of all other aspects that the municipality has been trying to do. But I think there should be, when you talk about the policy implementation, we're talking the challenges are that there are duplication of roles. Who does what? Who does what? Especially you see now the issue of EPWP. Municipalities, they've got their own ways of doing it to address maybe challenges of food insecurity, also women inequality, all those. And also the government has got their own priorities. So this kind of duplication of roles is the most challenge. So I think there should be, when there are policies, when there's lobbying or stakeholders, you see like the way we do in the budgeting, whereby you can bring the budget to the community, people can come together and see what are the community saying about the budget. The same should be happening when it comes to the implementation of unemployment and food security initiatives that whatever the municipalities have, and also the NGOs, they see how can they play a role. And also mostly the challenges is this issue of accountability, right, is the most challenging issue. And also, let's say, for example, the municipalities, they say they want to implement some food security or agrarian kind of programs. Who are they contracting to do the issues? Experience, it is. Those are some of the aspects also we should play hand in hand with, so that all stakeholders are involved.
Professor Adrino Mazenda from the University of Pretoria, thank you very much for talking to me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Well, summer is tantalizingly close and thoughts might turn to property sale. And to that end, the Seif Property Group says that selling property is best done in the summer months. Well, more now from Samuel Seif, chairman of the Seif Property Group. And firstly then, how does the current state of the South African property market compare to previous years? I guess in terms of buyer confidence as well as market activity.
I think, and this is, you know, people always say, oh, estate agents, I'll always tell you this is the time to buy. You know, this is the good time, etc. But through my, happily or sadly, depending which way you want to look at it, decades of involvement, I just get the feel at the moment this would be a good time to get into the market. We've been in a very, very sluggish market since the interest rates moved up from the low of 7% in 2020, 2021, where there was a lot of activity. Interest rates moved up. We're now at 11.75. They're far too high and have been constraining the market. That, with the question of the confidence of the future of the country, et cetera, has definitely put the market significantly into a slower position. We're seeing probably a 25-30% less number of units sold than we were 2-3 years ago. And as a result, there's a fair amount of stock on the market, particularly in the Gauteng region, but in many places in South Africa, even in the Western Cape, where there's a so-called perceived a shortage of stock. We've seen an oversupply. It looks to me like now is a good time to enter the market. I think sentiment in regarding South Africa is starting to improve. I think that's the one big plus. And I definitely think we're going to see a cut in interest rates September, probably again November, and probably a couple of times again next year, which means if you're buying at the peak, your interest rates will come down. It'll make it more affordable. Now's the time to get in and to negotiate. And it just has that feel. There are certain times in the marketplace where you have that. Unfortunately, nobody goes out and rings a bell and says, right, now's the time to buy. But it just has that feel at the moment.
Of course, the difficulty for people in your position is to try and convince the market to overcome that reticence or hesitancy, given the perception that currently exists.
Yeah, that's it's standard for us. And the big plus at the moment is with the new government of national unity, there seems to be a renewed confidence in the opportunity and the potential for South Africa. And when we compare what's going on around the world and the leadership and all the other problems, etc., people are saying, hey, well, you know, maybe it's greener, the grass is greener on the other side just because there's more fertilizer there. So maybe now's the time to start looking and seeing if we can't commit to South Africa. Let's make that purchase. Let's get in. A lot of people have been holding back. I think that's going to be a big change in the market, is the potential that, you know, we've got our problems. We know we have, but at least we now look like we've got a government who wants to get in and help sort it out for all South Africans, and there might be a better future here.
And where do you think the sweet spot is right now in terms of price?
Well, it's different to all different markets. I mean, you know, the average price at the moment for South Africans right across the board is around about 1.4 million rand. The mortgage prices are a little bit lower. The average mortgage is around about 1.2. So there's just around about a 10% deposit. My view is that if you can buy a little bit above that and negotiate down, you've done well. I think the market will begin to re-rate. This is my perception. And even in the Western Cape, which has had a lot more activity than any other markets, we haven't seen massive price appreciation other than certain areas in the Stellenbosch areas, Paarl, Franschhoek, etc., where people have gone for specific lifestyle. Even in the southern suburbs of Cape Town, in the Atlantic seaboard, you've seen a little bit more activity over the last year, but not at higher prices. We're more or less stayed static in prices since 2017. It's a long time to be static with no appreciation. And I just get the feel that the market is about to re-rate.
I'm always interested in this notion of seasonality when it comes to selling or buying a property. What, Samuel, are the most critical elements that can influence marketability, particularly during the summer season, which certainly here in Johannesburg is approaching us a lot quicker than we might have thought?
Yeah, look, there is such a thing as seasonality. I mean, people do go out. They do look for properties. Everybody's in a much better mood. Now, I know you've had pretty mild winter in Johannesburg this year. So there has been a fair amount of activity. But here, where I am in the Cape, there's been an enormous amount of rain. It's been cold. People don't actually like to venture out. Difficult to keep homes clean. Difficult to make them look as attractive. So there's no doubt then, you know, when you have a good summer's day, you can open up the doors, you can lead out into the garden. If you're fortunate enough to have a swimming pool, you can make that look attractive, etc. You have a much greater view and feeling from the buyers and a propensity to go out and look and purchase. Interestingly enough, what happens is we get a lot of activity over the November pre-season up to mid-December period, not as much sales, but the best-selling month in South Africa, which is the shortest one, is February. In general, that actually records the highest number of units generally in a month.
I'm going to leave it there, and as always, Samuel Seif, thank you very much indeed for that insight.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, it's over for another 4 years as the Olympic flame heads to Los Angeles. So you might have won that medal, but I wonder if it's worth anything. My next guest says this year's gold medals are likely to be the highest value of any gold in the history of the modern games because of the record high prices for the precious metal, surpassing the 13,000 rand record for the 2012 London Olympic medals. Tarina Flock is the managing director of Elite Risk Acceptances, a high net worth insurer and subsidiary of Old Mutual Insure. And first of all then, Tarina, is the value in the gold or in the glory?
Intrinsically, the value is definitely sitting in the gold, the weight of the metals, and of course those little pieces of Eiffel Tower that's in there. So intrinsically, that thing only has the value that can be determined based on the metal content. But of course, it's got way more value than the estimated $950, especially to the winners.
Completely right, because I mean, that's something that they have worked for so many years for and will remain with them for the rest of their lives. Tarina, I'm interested in one aspect that you've just raised, though, the unique factors of the medals this year, particularly the inclusion of pieces of the Eiffel Tower. Maybe just enhance for me the collectible value of this year's medal in that respect.
Well, you know, these unique additions to the medals brings with it a cultural and historically significant inclusion, which means that, as you suggested, the collectible value will obviously increase exponentially. Again, a collection item is probably as valuable as how much a willing buyer is willing to pay for it. But yes, they definitely have some more cultural significance because of this inclusion. Now, this makes these medals not only unique, but irreplaceable. Mm. And as insurers, we can only compensate clients for a financial loss. Unfortunately, we can't pay for that cultural significance, the hard work that went into it, that sentimental value that, unfortunately, insurers cannot compensate, you know, their clients for.
And of course, I mean, and nor should they have to either. Tarina, let me ask you this before we talk about the appraisal of an Olympic gold medal. I'm assuming as well that the rising price of gold going forward obviously has an impact on the current and the future value of Olympic gold medals, and conversely, if there's a drop in the gold price.
Absolutely, absolutely. They said that the previous medals were from the Tokyo Olympics were the most expensive to date. But then with the current price of gold, as the price of gold increases, the same goes for jewelry. As the price of gold increases, the more valuable the item that contains the gold is.
So let's assume then that you have an Olympic gold medalist phone you up and they say, well, you know, we think it's, we should have this insured. How would you go about appraising it? And maybe explain to me as well why it would be important for a medalist not only to have the initial appraisal, but going about this practice regularly.
Yeah, so firstly, sports memorabilia is a big thing. There are serious collectors of sports memorabilia, as I'm sure you are very well aware.
Indeed. Mm.
So I would, if I were in their position, I would go to somebody that is an experienced appraiser of sports memorabilia. A simple Google search can show you and, you know, a check. But the main thing is that that person mustn't have an interest in acquiring that piece. So it must be an honest appraisal of the value of the piece. I am very glad that won't be my job because I have no idea how they would go about doing it. However, they do consider factors like uniqueness, rarity, historical significance, and of course then also the weight of the precious metal. And then I would go to if I decided to have it insured, of course, people don't have to have these items insured. But if I decided, I would approach an insurer that specializes a little bit more in unique, maybe high valued items, because usually those policies don't have limitations on them as a general insurance policy could have, and then agree based on that, the outcome of that appraisal, agree with the insurer what the compensation will be in the event of damage or loss. So that's the steps I would take.
I'm interested in your observation about sports memorabilia, and you work in the whole process of elite risk. Do you find that there's a huge amount of interest in sports memorabilia, and are people aware of the value sometimes that they might own?
I'm sure people are. We don't have access to all the detail, but collections, any type of collections, are definitely a very important consideration as part of your insurance portfolio, because these things have value, and exactly the same with sports memorabilia. They do have value, and they have growing value. So it is very important to assess the risk correctly and together with the appraiser, with the broker and the insurer, decide how this risk is going to be treated.
And Tarina, I'm sure that if one were to win a gold medal at the Olympics, it's not something that you always want to store away, that it's something that you need to be proud of displaying. So you would also need, I imagine, to ensure that the medal is adequately protected if it is worn in public, you know, maybe something like a victory parade or arrival at an airport or something in that respect.
Yes, yes, absolutely. When I was doing a little bit of research, because I recall last year with the World Cup, there were rumors that somebody tried to steal the Webb Ellis Trophy.
There were,
but that
indeed.
Was only rumors. They were apparently only rumors. But what happened was a very excited fan wanted to grab the thing, so it could easily happen without the intention of stealing, or it could be stolen. So it is very important for these winners to never let these medals, if they're in public, leave their necks. Don't hand it to somebody to admire it.
Sure.
So yeah, it is. You know what? It sounds like you know, stupid points to consider, but these things have value and they can go missing. And of course, when it comes to unique and rare items, it's also very, very important how you handle it. You know, many collections are handled with gloves, so these metals can, you know, tarnish if touched. So it's important to keep these items safe.
And just a quick one, it's also about making sure that storage is done correctly as well. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. So as you correctly said, I would want to display it. So definitely if it's ensure that it's in a safe container for display, that if necessary, that there's an alarm linked to it, especially if it's a very rare and valuable item. And I'm thinking of some trophies may even be brittle, you know, and like tennis trophies that can be made of crystal or something like that. So if you want to display those items, make sure that it's safeguarded against accidental damage and breakage.
Tarina Flock, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much for the insight. I don't think you and I are ever going to win an Olympic gold, or at least I know I speak for myself. But thank you very much for talking to me today. I appreciate your time. And just before I bid you farewell, on our last online poll, I asked if you believed that crime in South Africa is under control. Yes, no, or efforts are underway. And well over 80% of our respondents, and we had a lot of feedback, not convinced that we are making any inroads at all. And today, and this links to one of our earlier interviews, food security in South Africa. Do you think it's under control? Do you think the risk is rising, or we need a new strategy? If you have a view on that, you can participate on our X or LinkedIn pages. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.